This is the Captains of Change session, where we'll hear from Graham Innes will chair a Q&A question and answer session with various captains of the sector. Just want to make sure that you're in the right room. That's what we're doing here today. There are breakout sessions in Park A and Park B. If you're interested in the deafblind world, please make your way to Park. I always get Park A and Park B muddled up. And also if you're interested in the by the numbers session, that's in Park B. Have I got that around the wrong way? Most of you would have your programs in front of you. Well, there are plenty of us here in the room here today because I think this is going to be a fabulous session. I will, after the session has concluded, I'll come back to the microphone just to give some afternoon announcements, but I will now hand over straight away to Graham Innes to chair this next session. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Robin, and good afternoon. Oh, there are some people here, not like this morning. That's fantastic. Thank you very much. Hello and welcome to Captains of Change. I'm Graham Innes, the former Disability Discrimination Commissioner, in case you weren't here when I did the keynote this morning. Sorry, Tony Jones wasn't available, so you've had to put up with me again. That's coming off the bench twice in one day. That's got to be a good effort. But this is a Q&A-like session, just as if Tony Jones were here. And the session will be podcast, and it will be available as a package later, and the caption transcripts will also be available, of course, through the conference organising committee. And it's captioned on the screen on the left of the stage, so to my right, your left. So, the aim of the session is to discuss how the role of commissioner, or similar role, not all of these guys here are commissioners, but how the role of commissioner or similar can best be utilised by advocates to safeguard the rights of people with a disability. And I want the session to be fast and furious, so I expect you all to participate and ask questions. So none of this settling in for a snooze after your excellent lunch, all right? This is going to be a busy session. Now, we have a range of commissioner-like people, we're calling them captains because we couldn't think of a better term, to answer your questions. And see, now that I'm not a commissioner-like person, I can be mean to all these guys. I've got full permission. So, so we'll see how we proceed this afternoon. But let me introduce them to you. Firstly, on my left, your right, Laurie Harkin, the Disability Services Commissioner. Please welcome Laurie. Next to Laurie, Colleen Pearce, the Public Advocate. Bernie Geary, the Principal Commissioner for Children and Young People. And then to get... I missed that one, I think.
I just wanted to clap louder.
Oh, right, fair enough. Bernie didn't think he's got as much applause as some of the others, so you might bear that in mind and give him the harder question. So... and then I'm sitting next to Bernie, and next to me on my right, so going towards your left, is Kate Jenkins, the Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commissioner. And Dr. Grant Davies, the Acting Health Services Commissioner. And we have an apology from Frank Lambrick, who was going to join us as well, but is not well today, unfortunately. So, let me tell you about the format. How is this session going to work? Well, first we're going to hear from the captains. And they've got 5 minutes, exactly 5 minutes, and I'll be timing that. So I'm not sure how I'll stop them after five. That could be an interesting challenge. But I'll ask them all five questions. And they can divide their time, their 5 minutes, as they like. And then once we've had those five questions... and I've asked each of the five captains, it'll be over to you to ask the question. So that's how the process is going to work. So let's get straight into it because I want to maximise the time for you to ask these guys questions because we don't often have the chance of getting this many people such as this into a room in one place where we can ask them questions. So let's take full advantage of it. And let's begin with the five questions, and I'm going to start with Laurie Harkin. So, Laurie, again, welcome. Question one, how would you describe your role?
It's a privilege. I've been doing this for, well, this is my eighth year. It's a privilege to do the work that I do. It's an opportunity to influence the sector and an opportunity to influence government. That's how I see it. It's also a not insignificant challenge to encourage people to speak up. A lot of folks with disability have, that's not been their experience. They have not necessarily been environments that have necessarily been that supportive of their life circumstances. And I sat through the earlier presentation from the folks who spoke about their experience with education. Again, I have a view that that's something that probably needs some independent oversight as well in respect to the complaints processes in that organisation, but that organisation knows that. So it's an opportunity to say and do a lot of things and advocate for at least the Act and more, because I take an aspirational view to the rights of people with disability.
Thanks, Laurie. What are your key goals in the disability space for this year?
For this year and probably the next couple of years, Graham, the thing that most consumes us is taking the message nationally around the safeguarding arrangements into the NDIS environment. If thoughtful consideration is not given to what those sorts of rights and protections and the enshrining, if you like, of those arrangements into future service provision are not appropriately thought through well in advance of getting to the NDIS, then that will be a big problem for people with a disability.
I'm sure we'll talk about that more this afternoon.
But,
yes. Laurie, which of your mistakes, and I'm sure you haven't made very many, but which of your mistakes provided you with the best learning, and what did you learn from those mistakes?
Well, it could, of course, be my decision to come here today. And I'm yet to discern the full learnings available to me until this has ended. But more generally, I think I've probably learnt most from imagining that that more people politically shared my view around social inclusion of people with a disability. So that which I've learnt, I've sought now to translate into action. The learning in particular, I appeared not so long ago before the current Victorian Parliament's Family and Community Development Committee and talked to them about social inclusion, which is what they're talking about. I have more and more understood that until all of us recognise our part as members of the village and share as members of the village the responsibility for care of the vulnerable of our fellow citizens, until we move to a position where we see all people as fellow citizens. Some people have different abilities. We're some way from that yet, and that's the learning for me. Is I'd made an assumption a while ago that more people saw the world that way, and the more I've learnt, the more I've become disturbed that that's less how society views it.
I think we've all made that mistake at one time or another. Thanks, Laurie. Now, in the 1 minute, 15 seconds you've got left, how can advocates best use your position to achieve change in the disability space?
There's a particular issue that concerns me, and that is the right to be free from abuse in care. And I would have hoped that the advocacy sector, and I've spoken to assembled gatherings, are you practising the movement of that bell, or should I just a quiet tinkling in the background?
Yeah, it's all right, Laurie. I've sent it away.
One of the things that my office has been doing in the last couple of years or so has been reviewing what is described as Category 1 incident reports, which are incident reports around an event that's occurred around alleged bad behaviour, assault, abuse of some kind by a staff member to a person receiving services. And the insight that we have, which is a dark window through which to look, but the insight that we have and the learnings that we need then to take forward is a powerful one, and for me, if we don't take as a state government, as a society, those lessons learned into the future, we will continue to have people subject to bad treatment, despicable behaviour, unlawful behaviour, and people with disabilities being their rights ridden right over the top of, and it's simply not on.
Thanks, Laurie. Last question. Which book is currently on the top of the pile on your bedside table?
Well, I don't have piles on my bedroom table. As it happens, I'm more discreet. But I've recently reread James A. Michener's The Source. That's not about tomato or other kinds of ketchup. It's a different meaning.
Thanks, Laurie. Okay. Thanks for that, Laurie. That's a great introduction, and we'll come to ask you more questions later this afternoon. So let's go to our next person on the panel, Colleen Pearce, the public advocate. Colleen, welcome.
Thank you.
Let me ask you firstly, how would you describe your role?
Well, my role is to promote, protect, and uphold the rights and interests of people with a disability, and my office does that in a number of ways. Primarily, I'm appointed by VCAT as guardian of last resort for people with a decision-making disability. But also, we have... the office undertakes a range of individual and systemic advocacy where we are trying to ensure that people with disability, insofar as is possible, can live full and happy lives. But we also have what I describe as an army of volunteers. So we have over 900 volunteers working for the Office of the Public Advocate. Mm. And we sit in on police interviews wherever a person has an apparent cognitive impairment. And last year that was over 2,500 police interviews we sat in on. Mm. We also visit people in disability services, so in residences, in supported residential services, and also in acute mental health settings. So they're closed environments that many people would never visit. So I guess they're probably the key ways in which we work.
Sure. What are your key goals for this year, Colleen, in the disability space?
Well, like Laurie, a really critical goal is the issue of safeguarding under NDIS. I have some really grave concerns about what the Commonwealth Government will adopt in terms of safeguarding, and we're particularly concerned that there will be circumstances where people in the community will not have access to the protections as afforded by Laurie's office or my office, and will have to rely on consumer affairs laws in order to gain protections, and that is a very complex route to go down. So I'm very concerned about that. I'm very concerned about issues of abuse of people with a disability. In fact, I'd say the two biggest human rights issues facing people with a disability are the use of restrictive interventions and, secondly, abuse of people with a disability. And just very quickly, two other key goals are we're currently, the office is currently developing a Koori Inclusion and Action Plan, and we know that our Indigenous citizens have significant numbers of people with disabilities but are not accessing the current disability service system. So that's an issue for my office. And finally, we have a supported decision-making pilot in Barwon, and we're very keen to look at how we can support people to make their own decisions rather than going down the route of guardianship.
Mm. It's interesting, isn't it, that the first two of you to answer that question have talked about the NDIS, and I think politicians have very clearly got the message that all of us in the disability sector campaign very hard for the NDIS, and we're all watching that it doesn't get broken. So that's great. Colleen, which of your mistakes provided you with the best learning, and what did you learn from those mistakes or that mistake?
Well, I think my, I don't know if I'd call it a mistake, but I certainly underestimated when I came into this role how difficult it would be to raise the issues of abuse against people with a disability. Mm. And the first time I raised that, there was absolute disbelief. Mm. And why was I raising this? Because the minister at that particular time had said, well, her department hadn't told her, so it simply wasn't happening. But more than that, it's the issue of the gendered nature of abuse of people with a disability, and we know that women are more likely to be victims of assault and sexual assault, that is an incredibly important matter that we need to understand. But the forces that are arrayed out there in trying to change the culture, both in disability service providers but also in the wider community, where it's acceptable to take away the rights of and dignity of an individual by subjecting them to cruel emotional and physical abuse. It's just unacceptable.
You're close to your time, but how can advocates best use your position to achieve change in the disability space?
Well, there's two ways. On an individual level, it's contacting. We have a telephone advice service, and ringing our telephone advice service, that triggers either a visit of a community visitor where that's appropriate, or in some cases advocacy by either our telephone advice line or our an advocate guardian, but more importantly just giving individuals and their families the support that they might need. Or secondly, it's getting in touch with us if you think there's a systemic advocacy issue that my office can take up.
Okay, and which book is currently on the top of the pile on your bedside table?
Well, I'm currently reading Burial Rights, and that's a very cheerless book about the last woman who was executed in Iceland.
Oh, okay. All right, thanks very much, Colleen. Let's come to Bernie Geary. Bernie, how would you describe your role?
My role is, as I use it, an extension of my being a big, fat, bull-fetted old youth worker, actually. I've been a youth worker for 45 years, and I see in the Children and Young Persons Commissioner's role an opportunity to continue that, but to be able to impact sometimes individually and sometimes systemically. Fortunately, under new legislation about a year ago, the commission operates with much more independence. I no longer have to tell a minister to tell me to do something before I do it. Mm. I now have an own motion capacity, and we are impacting particularly in the area of vulnerable children in every way that we can. I find myself actually connected very strongly in the out-of-home care area.
Mm. Okay. And what are your key goals for this year in the disability space, Bernie?
I think, and I don't want to sound like I'm... I think it's a general space, and that is inclusiveness. And I heard Steph say before just how important inclusiveness is, and it is the answer. I'm running a dev ball for kids in out-of-home care, as I do every second year next week, and part of that is specifically involving some people with disabilities, one young man in particular who's wheelchair bound, and the generosity of the other people, the other residential care kids, is incredible. So I just want to be inclusive and maintain that openness as much as I can, and to learn and work with others in the disability space.
Which of your mistakes, you probably haven't made any mistakes, Bernie, but which of your mistakes provided you with the best learning, and what did you learn?
My life is riddled with mistakes. but the mistake that that I hear in my own mind most of all is one that I made when I was a young teenager. I am one of five boys and a younger sister who has a disability, a profound intellectual and physical disability. And I remember very strongly not wanting to bring my friends home. My sister is fairly bizarre and really in your face and really loud, and I didn't want to bring my mates home. We'd just moved from the country to the city. My mother, who only died last year, aged 97, would walk my sister around the block every evening, much to my chagrin. I was horrified. But it became so obvious to me and my brothers very soon that she was saying to the world, this is my daughter and this is her community. And it taught me a wonderful lesson about the value of community, the generosity of community, the importance of community with vulnerable children, and I see all the time and use every opportunity I can to involve the community, and that certainly applies to disability.
Thanks, Bernie. That's a really powerful story, isn't it? And thanks for sharing that with us, because I reckon I'll tell that story in the future. That's a great story. Thank you. How can advocates best use your position to achieve change in the disability space?
Certainly, I think by encouraging me to identify windows of opportunity, and I think that sometimes I miss those, more mistakes, such as protecting the Victoria's Vulnerable Children Inquiry. I don't think I use that anywhere near enough, because I see so many young people with disabilities in our systems, in our out-of-home care systems and in our youth justice systems. Almost every residential care facility I go to, I find a person with a slight disability or a profound disability who shouldn't be there. Mm. So I want people to come to me and be loud and trumpeting, so that I can be loud and trumpeting around the needs of these young people and around their specific needs, and insisting that they don't get hidden in broader systems.
Careful what you wish for, Bernie. This is a room of advocates, you know.
People know that about me.
Yeah, no, I'm sure that's right. And which book is currently on top of the pile on your bedside table?
I really wish I could say something deep and meaningful. But I have a book called Coleman. Has anybody heard of the book Coleman? It's about an old football hero of mine that has just been written. And it's a wonderful book, and it takes me for a walk in my childhood, because it's about a fellow who was my hero in the 1950s, so that's what I'm reading.
Thank you, Bernie, and now I'm prepared to share the book that I'm currently reading, which is, for the second time, or at least the second time, maybe more, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. All right, let's come to Kate Jenkins, the Victorian Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commissioner. Welcome, Kate. How would you describe your role?
So I might describe my role by using the vision of the Commission. And our vision is that we have a community where every person values, understands and respects human rights and equal opportunity. So what that means in practice is I'm a Victorian Commissioner, and Graham, you have up until recently been a federal counterpart, is in Victoria. I'm responsible for a whole lot of functions under the Equal Opportunity Act, the Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities, and the Racial and Religious Tolerance Act. Mm. And those acts give us a whole lot of functions, including taking complaints and running education programs, running projects on systemic discrimination issues, doing submissions on new laws. So a huge range of functions. And unlike you, I'm responsible for all the different grounds of discrimination, but disability is one of the key ones that has our attention.
So what are your key goals in disability for this year?
So when I just started last year, and we redeveloped our strategic plan, and in looking at that, we particularly decided that we would focus our attention on a few key areas, and one of them was the rights of people with disability. So in terms of the focus for this year, I guess the most recent immediate focus is to make sure that our recent report called Beyond Doubt is implemented. So Beyond Doubt was a research project we undertook looking at the experiences of people with disability reporting crime. We know that people with disability, we're often focused on them as perpetrators of crime, but they're a much greater chance than the general population of experiencing crime and witnessing crime. And what we knew from our disability reference group was there was a view that the rights of those people were, they experienced systemic and pervasive barriers to being able to report crime and ultimately to have those crimes prosecuted. So there's a couple of other things, but that's top of mind. We have a number of other reports, and I look around this room and know many of you know our work, looking at relinquishment, looking at the experience of kids in schools, kids with disabilities in schools. So making those things happen, but also making sure we're reaching out to people who could complain to us who perhaps haven't used us before, so that we're more accessible to everyone.
So which of your mistakes, Kate, provided you with the best learning, and what did you learn?
I agree with everyone, there's lots of mistakes.
Yeah.
But one thing that I've really learned, I came from 20 years in the corporate sector, and one thing that I've really learned in the last 10 months of this role is when I started, on about day one, I was told, nothing about us without us, Kate. Now, in the corporate sector, if you want to do something, you just do it. Mm. You ask questions later, and you pretty much figure out what, the politics of everything's complicated. One of the things I've really learnt in this role is the power, one, of listening and understanding what the real issues are, and it's across the board in the different groups, but certainly we have our disability reference group that I'll come back to, in the Aboriginal community. If I was to decide what was best, you can be sure that would not be right and wouldn't make the change that's needed.
Mm.
And then from there, finding how you can bring people along. We're a commission of 70 people. If we want to change the whole of Victoria, it's going to need to be more than just me.
Yeah.
So can I just do one plug for our disability reference group, because I know there's some members in the room and others who applied. So I'll just... we have this really a fantastic group. It's 18 people. Every 2 years we have applications for a new group, and this is the group that really... tells us what's going on. It's a hugely diverse group, whole lot of attributes, whole lot of experience, some very articulate people and some people who haven't got to use their voice before. And I guess I'll just mention that the last round we had 70 applications, and every single one of them could have got on the... And some of you will be in this room, and I know a number of people have called and said, what can we do better next time? And my unfortunate thing is I just say, apply again next time, but it was an impossible task. So in the end, we just chose a number of people with different experiences to help us. And I'm really trying to hatch up how I can make sure that we're still communicating with others who are interested in contributing.
Now, you're really tight for time,
yes.
So I'm going to hold the next question for you to the broader discussion in the panel, because it's something that I want to talk about more, which is how advocates can best use the positions of the various people at this table to progress the disability agenda. So I'll come back to you with that. But I am interested to know which book is currently on the top of the pile on your bedside table.
My pile's always huge because I love reading and I seem to have no time.
Mm.
So I know the one at the moment that, as for most of my books, I've read the first chapter of is, and I Googled it to find the name, but it's called The Forgotten Rebels of Eureka, and it's by Claire Wright, and it's a book about women who are involved with the Eureka Stockade. And it just... The reason I'm really interested in this is I think the importance of stories, it's so important.
Mm.
And really the opening contention is the history of Eureka, and a lot of our history is about the history of men, and they've left out women and they've left out people with disabilities and they've left... And so this is saying, I'm not going to undo anything about the myth, but actually there were women there, and they've just been written out of history.
Yeah.
So really interesting.
And Aboriginal people have been written out of history too. And one of the things I only learned a year or two ago is that the Aboriginal women who came into the stockade in the middle of the night before the major battles and took the kids away so they'd survive the fighting, the white kids and Aboriginal kids, and we don't learn that in history either. So it's really interesting. Thanks for that, Kate. Now, the last captain at the table this morning, and I think this indicates that I was a commissioner for far too long, but the last captain at the table is the only person with whom I haven't served on at least one committee. So I don't know Grant as well as I do some of the other commissioners, but welcome, Dr. Grant Davies. And Grant, how would you describe your role?
Some might say not dealing with me is a blessing rather than a disadvantage. But how would I describe my role? My role's a generalist role. It's we receive complaints from consumers of health services about health services in Victoria. So we're a good generalist service. We get around 8,000 inquiries a year, which translates into about 3,500 complaints. So we get through a bit of work. We don't investigate, by and large. We take an alternative dispute resolution approach to our work. And we resolve that by getting the parties together to talk about what their issues are and getting the parties to generate some of those solutions. And some of those solutions can be explanation, apology, change in practice, or, you know, sometimes compensation. And I guess I see my role as making sure that my staff have the necessary skills and abilities to do that in a safe way.
Thanks, Grant. What are your key goals for this year in the disability space?
Some of you may be aware that we're, my primary act, the Health Services Conciliation and Review Act, is under review, and I'm trying to position the office in a way that takes that sort of prepares us for what might come out of that review.
So, survival's your primary goal, Grant.
Well, yes, pretty much. So we're changing our organisational structure. We're shifting into mixed teams. We're changing our processes to make them more flexible and responsive to people's needs, because we know that health services, people in a health or receiving a health service are sometimes vulnerable, and people with a disability are sometimes more vulnerable. So we want to try and make sure that we're more responsive to people's needs in that way.
Okay, thank you. Now, which of your mistakes provided you with the best learning, and what did you learn?
Actually, Bernie's reminded me of a situation in my youth. His story reminded me of that. I had a sister who was Down syndrome. She died last year, and I have a twin sister who's got an intellectual disability. And I was travelling home on the train when I was at school, and some people who were on the train were giving a Down syndrome boy a hard time. I'm actually finding this difficult to talk about, to be honest. And I said, look, you know, you need to leave this guy alone. He's not doing anything to you. He said, well, if you like it so much, why don't you go sit next to him? And, you know, to my shame, I wasn't able to do that at that age. But it really made me think about what are my values, you know, and it really encouraged me to subsequently put my money where my mouth is and really follow up on making sure that, and I'm very sensitised to people with a disability, so you can appreciate the sort of headlines around GAMI, for example, are resonating quite strongly for me at the moment.
Yep, with all of us, I think. It's interesting, isn't it? I think it was it wasn't Angus Houston, it was the next chief of services who said that the standards we walk past are the standards we accept, and it's so true in this sort of area. And it's one of those powerful lines that I always remember, because I've been in similar situations myself and haven't necessarily stood up. So I can appreciate you, and thank you for telling us that story, Grant. How can advocates best use your position to take advantage to achieve change in the disability space?
Well, you need to help me help you, basically. So we could do better in this space. I'm the first to admit that. Office of the Health Services Commissioner could do better in the disability space. So we actually need advocates to, tap me on the shoulder and say, hey, I think you could do better here and here and here and here, I'll do my best to do it.
Okay, and your book, which is the current book on the top of your
iPod? My book's called Relic. In fact, it's on my iPod, so I don't have
a 21st century man.
It's on my iPad. I don't have stacks. Clean lines, Graham. Clean lines. Anyway, it's called Relic. It's about an FBI agent investigating a number of murders in the New York Museum, and it's by Lincoln Child and Douglas Preston.
Yeah. Thanks, Grant. All right. So now we come to all of you, and it's over to you. For your questions, you can ask an individual commissioner, captain, a question, or you can just ask a general question, and we'll all bat it around a bit. I'm going to try and keep the questions short and the answers relatively short because I want to get to as many questions as we can, and we've got two runners with microphones who are going to move around, because remember we are podcasting this session after the conference. So even though you've got big voices, as Robin said this morning, as advocates, we know that, but we do need to get you to use a microphone. So I think I'm sure our two runners are there and ready. Who have you got for the first question?
Graham, it's Helene. I'm going to quickly run over to one of the girls here, the ladies.
Well, thank you. It's Elizabeth McGarry from the Association for Children with a Disability.
Hi, Elizabeth.
Grant, I'm interested in the independence of your commission, and I'd like you to talk to us about the value of it being an independent body as it investigates unsatisfactory experiences.
It is independent. We don't advocate on behalf of either party. Because we're trying to help people generate solutions to the issues that are under grievance between them, we can't be seen as advocating on behalf of one party or another. So we don't, you know, in the traditional sense, we don't investigate, you know, capital I investigate issues very much. We do infrequently, but our main game is mediation and conciliation. So we work very hard with the parties in the room, and we work very hard with the parties separately to bring them together to resolve the issues between them.
Kate, that's probably a similarly relevant question for you. Do you want to? Would you like to comment about the commission and how it works in that regard?
Yes. So this is another one of those learnings for me, is walking the line. So we're an independent agency as well, but we do, you know. So I have a board. We're loosely within the Department of Justice, but a lot of the work we do is to shine a light on the practices of government agencies, government departments, Department of Education, Department of Justice, police. So that's I would say, one of the things that we do in that role. So we take complaints, but we have other functions as well, a bit more broadly, that we really work hard to try and work from both sides of the fence to try and empower advocates and help individuals know their rights and act on them, and also to help work behind the scenes with policymakers to try and change practice. We come at them both angles, and we use our relationships to try and convince them nicely. Sometimes when I'm said, you're not making enough of a fuss, that's because we're trying it from another angle, and we know there's some good people making a fuss somewhere else. So we'll often work with all those levers. And we know with some of the stakeholders that we work with that they know we can get influence where they've really been trying to get influence.
Sure. Others of you up here like to comment, or shall we pass on?
No, I don't mind.
Yep. Okay, next question, please. Yeah?
Very much. You probably all know my question because I've been sort of carrying it around for a number of years. But I've got a child with severe intellectual and physical disabilities, and when you were talking about the standards we walk past are the standards we accept, I think back in 2005 I first put in complaints, and have put in complaints again and again, in regard to support disability incident recording systems. I'm amazed that there aren't numbers on these incident reporting systems where the carer or the person who's responsible, and it's their duty of care to report that it isn't protected with that number. The Department of Human Services, for example...
Can we just get to the question?
Can we have initial question? Numbers on incident reports, please?
Yeah, sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Laurie, do you want to...
I'm not sure that I feel able to speak on behalf of the department.
Mm.
I get the point that Matthew is making. He's made it to me before.
Yep.
I don't have a strong disagreement with the point that he's making, but I'm not sure that I can speak on the department's behalf.
Anyone else like to comment?
Well, I've had the same conversation, Graham, with Matthew, and I can see no reason And so it's certainly a notion that is worth pursuing.
Mm. Okay.
Graeme, we've got four more questions.
Yes, let's go to the next one. Thank you, Helen.
Hi. I'll put my name down for the Disability Human Rights Commission Council. What would I have to do to get onto it? Because I never got to the interviews.
Okay, I think that one's for Kate.
Yes, I'm okay. Very happy to talk about that. I know there will be a number of people in the room. So our disability reference group is 18 people, but we tend to keep about half of them from the previous reference group. So this year, and I really feel like it marks a really good development, is we got 70 applications for, in essence, 8 spots. They were amazing applications. We covered huge ranges of backgrounds, huge range of experience, of lived experience of disability, carers, and the answer is, I've spoken to a number of people, is that this isn't a selection process that was ranked by quality. In the end, we just needed to choose a range of disabilities, a range of life experience. So thank you for applying, and I encourage you to continue.
Okay. Let's come back to you in a minute for another question, but let's keep moving to the questions that we've got, because I want to make sure we get to as many as we can.
Yeah, hi, it's Maurice Gleeson.
Yep.
First of all, I'd like to congratulate the panel. I think you can obviously hear and feel their passion and their commitment to what they're doing. What I'm really concerned in the disability sector, we're talking about, you know, how we want to make significant changes and make all the wonderful things happen, which is great, but I'm really concerned about the employment. I think in the disability sector, we're still very low, and I have no real evidence, so I haven't got a statistic, but employing people with disability to actually get meaningful employment within the sector itself. Does anybody have any comment?
So would people like to comment on that?
If I am correct that we are still fairly low, what can we actually do? Because I think it's fantastic to have reference groups. I think it's extremely valuable to call on people with knowledge. I see people with disability not as consumers, I see them as consultants. But I would really like them to actually have some meaningful employment.
Thanks, Maurice. Can I just merge that with one of the questions that I have on my list? And we might go along the table and have you answer this question, which is sort of what percentage of the staff in your office have disabilities, and what directions, what actions are you taking to increase that percentage? Who'd like to start with that question?
I'm happy to.
Great. Thanks, Laurie.
Stand up, so to speak. And it'll sound like an obfuscation of some kind. I don't disclose to people what disability I may or may not have, Graeme. It's a personal perspective of mine. But I have admitted, if you like, and acknowledged that I have a lived experience of disability personally in two different ways. And I'll speak to that just briefly. I, in writing a foreword for the Eastern Polio Network in Melbourne a couple of years ago, was encouraged to acknowledge that I am also a person with polio, and was contracted polio in the early 1950s when there was a significant epidemic across Australia. The presence of polio now is less obvious. It's what might be described as a hidden disability now for me, but I am still aware of its presence. I had the privilege of having a disabled son born with a disability, and he shared his life with my wife and I until he was 13. I have a sense from that lived experience of the need for advocacy. I was harangued once by a very notable Australian with a disability who has a much bigger national profile than I for talking in what appeared to them to be a condescending way. I make no apology ever for being the strongest advocate that my wife and I could possibly be for our son's circumstances, and the sun won't rise on the day when I won't hold that view strongly until I no longer breathe. The circumstances of people with a disability being adequately represented, whether by family members or through systemic approaches, leaves an enormous amount still to be desired. You will know, Graham, your own words, where you have described the numbers of people employed by the Commonwealth Public Service as being around 2%, and the words you use to describe it as shameful. You will know that the NDIS as an agency would quote the number of about 14% of the staff that work for the agency identify as having a disability, and a larger percentage identify having the lived experience of a disability. I don't ask people who work in my office do they have a disability when they join me. I seek always to appoint people regardless of gender or any other circumstance on the basis of the merits of the job. That's me being quite honest with you about my office's circumstances.
Thanks, Laurie. Who else would like to, Colleen? Would you want to go down the row, or would others like to?
Yes, I think you've raised a really important question, because I think the dignity of work, the dignity it brings having one's own income is very important. And I had this discussion with my niece, who's got an intellectual disability. She's currently at a TAFE school doing a Certificate 4. She's got currently on work experience with Target. And she said she went up to the manager of Target and said, "What do I have to do to, you know, to get a job here?" And he told her she had to work hard and do all of these things. And my sister said they've got no intention of giving her a job after this. And she's trying her best. So I think it is really critical. And if I go to my own office, we have a disability action plan. So we are committed to employing people with a disability. We haven't been terribly successful at that for a number of reasons. But our biggest issue that we've discussed endlessly and not perhaps got as far as we might is that my office focuses on people with cognitive disabilities, and how do we find in an office a role for a person with a cognitive disability, particularly in the public service where a lot of those roles have changed, and you things that you might have had a mail room to do or a range of tasks. I think about my niece, what role could she have in an organisation like mine? So the biggest challenge is those with a cognitive disability, and how do we find employment for them.
Thanks, Colleen. Bernie?
I think there are several issues. The one I'd like to zero in on is the voice of the person with the disability, and I know that applies in several ways to my role. The voice of the child is really important, and sometimes it's really hard to hear, and we tend to charge on assuming that we know all about what children want, and that's been really brought to my attention in the last 8 months since we've had a commissioner for Aboriginal children and young people, and I've become more and more aware of how we really kidded ourselves as to how we acknowledge the voice of Aboriginal children until he came. Yes.
Thanks, Bernie. Kate.
Okay, I agree. The issue of employment is connected with so many other elements of participation, and we do work looking at public transport, for example, because if you can get a job, you need to be able to get there. And the stats that someone with disability has it's twice as challenging to get a job. So in terms of our work, we're really focused on employment. We get complaints. And disability in employment is the largest number of complaints, but I'm very disappointed that I think a lot of those are about injuries experienced once in work, and that we don't get nearly enough complaints from people who, you know, are just unable to get work. We also, it's hotly contested at our board as to reporting on disability status of staff. I know my staff to know that we would... be above the community average. But our focus is on VPS. So we're aiming for, we think the Victorian Public Service should try and be an exemplar, and that that's a place for us to have our eye. Of course, as well, we also have plans around disability employment access, making sure our services are very accessible.
Sure. Thanks, Kate. Grant.
Like Laurie, it's not something that I've certainly ask potential employees. We're subject to the Department of Health's employment policies and principles. We're subject to the Department of Health's employment policies and procedures. We would certainly. There have been instances. I've not seen any disclosed people with a disability in any of our recruitment processes of late. But certainly, we have caused to make reasonable adjustment for people who have had sort of long-term mobility issues in recent times, and I see no reason why that couldn't be a permanent fixture. Certainly, our office is wheelchair accessible and is accessible in a range of ways. We certainly have flexible working arrangements. So. Yes, I mean, I couldn't tell you. They certainly haven't. None of my staff has disclosed any disabilities to me.
Thanks, Grant. All right.
Graham, can I say some more about this?
I do want to keep getting to other questions.
I understand.
Yep.
Can I just take the point that Colin made in particular, and other colleagues here about dignity? In the late 1800s, William Booth, the founder of the Salvation Army, developed a stone ark, and the keystone in the ark, at the top of this ark, simply said, "Work for all." If I've dealt with a lot of folks in homelessness, service provision in bygone times, people just need a job in order that they can lift themselves up from where they find themselves.
Yep.
It's absolutely the case for people with disability as well. I'm not convinced that governments are necessarily as committed and in economic terms as invested as they might be in terms of providing what's euphemistically described as reasonable adjustment to afford opportunity to enough people with disability. And I reflect, having employed people with significant hearing impairment, folks with significant visual impairment and blindness, and folks with cerebral palsy, and each of the conditions that those work colleagues brought to the environment required a not insignificant series of adjustments and investment in order to optimise their opportunity to thrive in that employment. And I'm not convinced, as part of my broad view about do we as a society see all citizens, see ourselves and people with disabilities as all fellow citizens on a shared journey, we're a long way from that, and I think this is an indicator of that.
I think that's absolutely true, Laurie. Thank you for that. And that's certainly a view that I share. We are a long way from that, and I talked about that this morning. But let's keep focused on the role of commissioners or captains that are here at this table, because I want to maximise the chance for advocates to ask questions of you and draw from your expertise in that area. And we did ask for questions from cyberspace, from Twitter and emails, and I've got them in front of me here. And one from Grant Roberts is, why is it that we effectively have no power to enforce things when it comes to disability? For example, the Disability Action Plan that federal, state and local government commit to or write every 3 to 4 years but rarely put into practice because they have no budget. Yet these plans are showcased on the Human Rights Commission site like a trophy gallery. Surely there has to be a legal framework around the Disability Action Plans so they are just not meaningless, and that the Human Rights Commission can enforce the same rules as the ACCC when they fine corporations and for not playing the game. Now, the Human Rights Commission, as of 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago now, is not represented on this panel, of course, but, I mean, it's a similar issue that applies to the Victorian Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission, and from the Human Rights Commission point of view, I'm sure that the answer we would get from Susan Ryan, who's who's taken on the role on a part-time basis of Disability Discrimination Commissioner, is that the Commission would be happy to look at that if the law were changed. But let's get some comments, perhaps starting with you, Kate, but from others, about, A, sure, maybe the law can be changed, but also, are there ways to reinforce those sorts of processes in other ways?
So the Victorian Act has a system of equal opportunity plans that can be filed with us. That's been around since 2010, but in fact we have no such plans that have been filed with us. The federal DDA had much better success in creating a bit of interest to get those plans posted, but I agree with that comment about the law, that the discrimination laws don't do a very good job except where there's a complaint. So they're designed originally around people bringing complaints, and that's why this room is a really important room to make systemic change. There's been some really great complaints, and I had Kevin Cox, who's the Queensland Commissioner, Discrimination Commissioner, down. He was talking about one of his early complaints about the Brisbane Convention Centre about the dignity of coming in the front door and not building a building to have people go around the back door. So I agree that question is a good question. I think if I use my strategic rather than my legal head, I think that social media is making a difference, that I've seen some significant changes recently. If you can tell the story well enough in media, and there's so many stories, that's not always logical, and try and create a reputation, I'm not officially saying this, but, you know, a question, then change can happen because of those pressures, and the laws kind of help a little bit along the way.
Anyone else like to comment on that question?
I think disabilities probably need somebody to hit the table politically for them. It's okay for us commissioners to be here, but I think if we've got a commissioner for gambling and a commissioner for horse racing, maybe a minister for gambling and a minister for horse racing, maybe we should have a minister specifically for disabilities.
Mm. Okay. Well, thank you for that. Let's go back to the room for questions. Helene, have you got the next one for us? We're just getting a microphone.
The man beside me tells me I am. My name's Philip Graves. I'm a physician, and I've been around in the disability field for 40 years. I've seen enormous improvements in the field in that time, things like deinstitutionalisation, creation of public advocates, creation of all your positions, for which I congratulate you. Enormous improvements, but I think my main feeling is one of frustration at lack of outrage at some of the disadvantages. You mentioned them, Graham, this morning. Poverty, employment, criminal justice system issues, and there are many more. And if I was more closely related to the disability field as a person with a disability or as a parent, my main emotion would be anger and frustration.
So can we just get to your question?
Yeah, so what do you guys think that you can do to increase the sense of urgency and outrage at the manifest unfairness in the system?
If I were asked that question, my one word would be Twitter, because I really do think social media can play a big role there. But who else would like to comment on that?
I'd just say that
Well, you do it well, so...
Trying to get traction with the media, so I don't tweet, haven't got that far yet, but certainly using that sense of outrage with the media, and it is really also standing up whenever we see injustice. And I used the example before of violence against people with a disability, and it is absolutely outrageous. And we have to be able to use that outrage in a very productive way, and one way to do that is to speak out publicly, and so others can share that outrage. They can't share it if they don't know about it, and too often disability issues are hidden, are invisible in our community. So it's making those issues visible.
And use the option, the opportunity you've got as commissioners, and when you bring out reports to make sure that that sense of concern and injustice and outrage is there. Mm. Would anyone else like to comment?
I'm currently in the status that I now have of independence. I have a capacity to do own motion reports, and the report that I'm concentrating on at the moment is the sexual assaults that take place in residential care services, and invariably. People with disabilities are the victims, and certainly that's something that I'll be putting forward very much in the report that I'm doing, and will be going to Parliament.
Great. Thanks for that question. Okay, we've got about 25 minutes left, so let's try and get through as many questions in that time as we can. Who else has got a question?
Graham, we've got a question here.
We'll come to you, sir, but we've got one over here first.
Laurie, I want to really ask you this question, because all the disability service providers that say they got no money to do the job, where is it going to end? I'm in a house where I shouldn't be. I'm getting abused because a lot of people in my house are gone intellectually disabled, and I don't understand where does this end, and where, and you got a physical disability and you're out in the country, what are you meant to do? And you're trying to put your name down for the city, but you want them for years. And, you know, the seven providers are really good out in the country, but they just need more support because they haven't got the funding and the materials that they need.
Sure. Thanks for that question. Laurie?
Well, what you're pointing up is the adequacy, or rather the inadequacy, of investment. One of the challenges is to garner enough interest across government to meet something towards adequate levels of funding to enable the circumstances that you describe not being the circumstances. I don't know whether I'm naively optimistic or just generally optimistic that the emergence of the NDIS will rebalance some of this very significant lack of investment that causes the circumstances that you are living through and describe to be the case. I don't know whether that will be how it is. I hope that will be how it is. you raise in your question one of the things that I've heard for the last number of years is the frustration that people feel with the Act under which I work. The Act, when it was written, didn't invite the holder of my office to have a view about the appropriateness of resource allocation. It enabled me to unpack in a complaints context how adequately, and often not very is the answer, decisions were made, and more particularly how decisions were communicated around resource allocation. It enabled me to form a view and say something to government and the department about resource allocation on the basis that the evidence would suggest that people's experience is not as they would want it to be, and this is a direct consequence of the adequacy or the inadequacy of resource allocation. But I don't have a capacity, and the legislation didn't afford me one, to say, and I therefore determine that this allocation is inadequate, it needs to be increased to this level, kindly do so.
Yep.
That's not what's invited. The other thing I'd caution people about is that if you go back to the Productivity Commission's own work around the scheme that's emerging now as the NDIS, one of the things that the Productivity Commission said was that in the development of a complaints response in a new NDIS world, that anything that dealt with complaints need to be mindful of and not put at risk the financial viability of the scheme. Now, that's a very significant thing to have been said. It's buried away in the 700 pages of the Productivity Commission report, and I caution my fellow citizens to be alive to this consideration, because it will only continue to play out in the adverse way that you describe, and I can only express my empathy for the circumstances that you describe.
Mm. Thanks, Laurie. Okay, let's go to our next question.
Greg's going to give you the next question.
Well, I'll get someone to... The people with the microphone are...
I'll give him the microphone.
Okay, all right. Please go ahead.
I won't be long. That's on. With the government, right? The government, if they ain't got any money, would the government do something about it?
I'm sorry, can I just have that question again? Because I
the government.
Yeah, the government. I got
yeah,
the government.
If you got no food, don't come to help price of food, don't they, to you in like in winter time?
Who do you talk? What do you mean? What section of government do you talk to if you haven't got enough
food?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Would anyone like to respond to that?
I'd probably want to understand more about your circumstances and perhaps
I'll speak up.
Well, no, I don't mean now. I mean perhaps separately.
I think that's right. Maybe if you have a chat to us afterwards, we might be able to give you some suggestions.
Right. Yeah,
I've got a few things in mind too.
But
maybe if you have talk to a couple of us at the end of the session, we can help you with that.
Yes.
Let's move to the next question.
Okay, no worries.
Thank you for that one.
Graham, we've got around 8 hands up.
Yes, I know, so I want to get through as quick, as many as I can.
My name is Clayton Hendricks, actually, and I'm a little on the problem with my my parents, and I want to know about what's happening about disabling legislation. That's what I need to know.
Sorry, what's happening about...
Because I got a disability, and also I got Down syndrome.
Yep.
And also I want to...
I just missed the last word you said. What's happening about...
Superannuation.
Okay. Look, I'm not sure that we're the right people to ask that question, but I think someone
Sorry,
like
Graham,
Kirsty Wilson might be a really good person to talk to about that.
Graham, I don't think that was the question.
Sure.
So why don't you? We might get that one dealt with again at the end of the session if we can.
Was it superannuation? That we
I think so.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's move to the next question. Who have we got, Helene? Helena? Sorry, Helene?
Sorry, just give me... Yep, David. David Scott.
Okay. Well, just while you're sorting that out, I might raise another one that I've got from the list here to members of the panel who might like to have a go at this. Can you give an example of how an advocate has used the services of your office? Obviously, you don't have to identify them if you don't want to. Of how they've used the services of your office most effectively to achieve change?
I can give an example on a very small scale.
Yeah.
That when I was organising my debutante ball, a lady came to me with her son, who, as I said before, is profoundly physically disabled,
yeah.
Wheelchair. And it became really difficult. And in a conversation on the phone, I said to her, look, maybe this is not going to work out well. It did, because she was a strong advocate, and she pulled me into line, and as I said, I went to the young people. But that was a person who was a strong advocate on something that might seem very small, but I wouldn't mind her on my side in any back alley, I can tell you.
Thanks, Bernie. Anyone else like to comment on that?
Yes, Colleen.
Colleen.
There's been numerous occasions where we've worked with advocates, and often we do that in partnership. So where a situation is identified, there may already be an advocate involved, and they may find that they're either not getting traction on the issue or they want more support. Mm. So it's often with my office that we will work in partnership, and that's our preferred way of working. And there's been countless times where that's been successful.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, thanks, Colleen.
There've been a number of times where advocates have played a significant role in the complaints resolution space with us, mm. Where they've really advocated very strongly for the consumer, for the person with the disability, and there have been better outcomes as a result in our resolution space.
Great.
And we would echo that.
Yeah.
That's the same. Using the laws to bring complaints and either resolve them or continue has made a big difference.
One of the things that I learned as a complainant, not as a commissioner, when I lodged all my complaints against RailCorp or Sydney Trains, as they now are, one of the things that I learned is that you never go to a conciliation conference without an advocate or a support person. Mm. Even I shouldn't. And I didn't, because I did it once, and that was probably the mistake that I made that I learned the most from. You can't separate yourself enough from the process when it's your complaint that's being dealt with, and so it's always valuable to have an advocate or a support person in a conciliation conference. So I think that's useful to remember. Now, I know there's a lot of hands. We've got 15 minutes
Graham,
left.
There's five hands right
five
in front
hands.
Of you, and those arms are getting so tired.
All right, well, let's
I'm
come
just
up...
going to advocate for
yeah,
a mic
no, good,
in
good
the middle.
Kate. Let's come up to the five arms in the middle, can we?
We've got one and then...
Well, yeah.
Hello, my name's Penelope. Thank you first for your time for coming to
share
your...
Can you
just
get a bit closer to the microphone, Penelope, because I can't hear you quite.
So my question basically would be to Kate to start with. Can or will an extra rule be created to make the medical profession a lot more accountable for their continuous abuse, ignorance, misunderstandings of people that suffer from mental health and hidden chronic disabilities? As I've discovered, the Health Commission services don't really assist, and it's a bit wishy-washy with their process, I must say.
All right. Well, Penelope, let's let Grant answer that question.
My experience of the medical profession, and I know this this might not accord with some of yours, but my experience is that most medical professionals want to help people, and I think sometimes they work from a position where they forget what they're there to do. They forget what the goal is in terms of their medical care. So I've found most of the time, if you raise concerns with the medical profession, they will listen and they'll respond to those concerns in a considered way. There are processes generally in public hospitals there are consumer liaison roles in public hospitals that assist people to bring concerns about their care. And of course there's now a mental health complaints commissioner who is able to take complaints about public mental health facilities.
And that's a relatively short time ago, that role, Grant, isn't it?
It started on the 1st of July.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Katie?
I'll just add to that, that we actually at the start of this year released some guidelines directed at GPs as providers of service. So the equal opportunity laws do apply to medical practitioners when they provide their services, and we had identified through a number of our stakeholders that the experiences with doctors weren't always good experiences despite best intentions of some of them. And we particularly worked with people in the disability area, mental health, as well as LGBTI community, particularly transgender people had some very bad experiences, and also people who couldn't speak English very well. So there are a whole range of issues. So those guidelines were to say, to provide a lawful service, here are the adjustments you will need to make for a whole range of those people. So I'd point you in that direction, and also that you can raise complaints. But we certainly do that guideline to both educate but also empower people to know their rights. So we have done some brochures targeted at that. So, yeah, that was our identified issue.
Thanks. Too. Thanks, Kate. So,
I was going to be very quick
yeah,
to say...
Yeah, just quickly.
Just as advocates, we thrive on your energy and your insistence too. So whether it's a health services commissioner or myself, or give us a hard time.
Yeah. I like people who give you permission in that respect, Bernie, so thank you. Now, let's get to some of those other tired arms that because I want to get through more questions. Yeah. Who's next?
With the National Disability Scheme, how...
Yeah. With the NDIS?
With the NDIS Disability Scheme.
Yep.
Where's that going to come through?
Well, it's in place in a number of regions already. It's in Barwon down here, and it's in the Hunter in New South Wales, and it started in a couple of other places. It takes about 5 or 6 years to roll out completely, so it will gradually cover more of Australia. Okay, next question, please.
Hello. Fiona Tipping from Grampians Disability Advocacy. I'm a disability advocate working in the Ballarat region.
Yes.
I've had to advocate for many clients with complaints to organisations like yours, but the problem that I'm finding is how I'm not funded to deal with systemic advocacy. We're too small an organisation, and a lot of my time is basically banging my head against a brick wall.
So what's
in
your
relation
question,
to the NDIS, for example? We're not in a region where the focus is on rollout. I'm concerned that the focus is so much on the rollout in regions where there is an NDIS that it's at the expense of people that aren't in a rollout site.
Okay, so what's your question, Fiona?
My question is, how do we safeguard the existing rights of people
safeguard
the rights of people who are not in a rollout site at the moment? The situation is there's no money, and I think it follows on from that other gentleman before. I've been told by many people within the department there's just no money. It seems to be crisis driven.
Well, Fiona, I think you've asked the question that the conference is all about, so I'm not sure how adequately we can answer that in a minute or two, but would anyone like to answer that question? How do we safeguard the rights of people with disabilities who aren't in NDIS areas?
Well, I'd like to have a go.
Sure. Thanks,
I think you've really asked what I think is one of the absolute critical questions, because what we do see is any additional money that is being put into disability is going into the rollout site. So try and get on the disability support register, try and get an ISP. I mean, there is nothing else available anywhere, and we are seeing pockets of extreme disadvantage as a consequence. And like you, I am very concerned about what that means for people who aren't in the rollout area. But particularly, it's the lack of individual support packages, and there are no new individual support packages or perhaps very few, and certainly not enough. And the thought of having to wait till 2017, till there's a broader rollout, is going to create enormous disadvantage and difficulties for people. So I just concur with you. I don't have a solution.
But it's clearly an answer that's before the commissioners that are up the front here. So thanks, Fiona, for that question.
Excuse me, can I ask a question of the
Laurie,
questioners?
Can you ask a question?
Of the questioners.
Yes, of course.
Can I just be clear? Were you also asking about the future prospects of funding for advocacy?
Okay.
All right. Well, let me give you a warning then. Given that you didn't ask, I'll tell you the answer that should be concerning to you. The NDIS plan to fund individual advocacy. There is no plan within the NDIS's future view of themselves to fund systemic advocacy.
Yep. I think that is something we have to watch. And I think that there's a paper on advocacy within the NDIS. Is it come out or is it about to come out? I can't quite remember.
No, it's not out yet.
Not out yet. But watch out for that when it comes out, because I think the advocacy sector will need to input into that that process and make sure that there's a broader view. I think it's a very good point, Laurie. Let's try and deal with a few more questions before we have to come to an end.
Martin Butcher from Disability Advocacy.
Hi, Martin.
My question is to Colin. We often get the issue where we are advocating for people with little or no capacity to make decisions. Yet we try and advocate on the wishes of people with disabilities. Where do you see the role of the intra-advocacy or alternate advocacy maker in terms of not restricting people but ensuring that those who don't have a capacity have busy decisions made for them or with them?
Thanks, Martin. Colleen.
Well, thank you for that. I think that's another really important question. And what we've seen is far too often that when we have a person with a disability, that people turn to guardianship. So that means, while it's a protective jurisdiction, it means that we are limiting the rights of an individual when they perhaps may have had the capacity to make decisions for themselves. And clearly the UN Convention on the Rights of People with a Disability calls us to, in the first instance, support people to make decisions for themselves, and that is absolutely critical. But how do we go about doing that? I mean, it's something that we haven't done before, shamefully. We've, as I said, too often turned to guardianship. That's why we've got the supported decision-making pilot in the Barwon region, where we're looking at how we can support individuals to make decisions for themselves. And I know that for some people with a disability, they've never been asked some of the really basic questions around what they would like to do. And surely with NDIS, and if we're talking about social inclusion, it should be based on individual choice and control. But how do people exercise that if they have never been encouraged or allowed to make decisions for themselves? So you're right, we need to work a lot harder to encourage models of supported decision-making, and guardianship should absolutely only ever be as a last resort for the shortest time possible.
Thanks, Colleen. We've probably got time for two more quick questions.
That lady there, she has to have the biggest biceps after this is all over. She's had her hand up for the last
hour.
There's
one I can almost point anyway.
All right. Well, let's try and...
Tell them
this is not the lady with the big biceps. She's sitting over to my left.
She'll be next.
Here's my question. I work in local government, and part of my portfolio is employment, of course. I'm bringing it back to employment. I sat in another session where... disappointingly, we heard that government is prepared to fight government to support tools of competency to keep people oppressed in crappy workplaces, and they'll spend hundreds and thousands of dollars to do that.
Okay. Let's just try and get to the question quickly,
how can we as a collective of advocates with all our individual pursuits join in to support people in this fight against
Well, it's just shameful oppression, really, to try and keep people on 33 cents an hour or, you know, $1.50 a day.
Okay. I'm not sure that we can deal with that in the time we've got, but I'm happy if anyone would like to talk about it.
You know, my response would be, you know, and I'm sure you do, and I see it now and then, is use the media, use local members, and it's a fairly vain answer. I'm sorry about that, but, I mean, we really, it's so important in terms of justice for people, so I'd say keep punching.
We often complain about our politicians. I don't think we go and visit them nearly enough.
Right.
And I think we've got to start knocking on their doors and talking to them about these real problems. I really encourage the advocacy sector to do that.
Yeah.
Would anyone else like to comment on that question?
And the peak bodies.
And the peak bodies, sure. But the politicians, we give them a... Mate, we let life be way too easy for our politicians, I reckon.
Look, if I could just share again that experience of trying to raise the issue of abuse of people with a disability, and that you would think that we would have done something about that a long time ago. Mm. And there's no shortcut. It's a long, hard slog.
Yep.
But I think you've got to build coalitions and just never, ever, ever give up, because we have to fight this injustice wherever we see it. So there's no shortcuts, and there's some solutions, and that's, you know, visiting politicians, raising it at every opportunity, try and form partnerships and just keep on fighting.
Yep, absolutely. There's plenty to do. All right, now I think we've probably got time for one more question, unless Robin tells me that we can have more. But we can have one more.
The bicep lady.
Yep.
Hello, my name's Tanya. I'm from Independent Advocacy up in Townsville.
Have you got a microphone, Tanya?
I do.
Oh, I just can't hear
better?
Very well. That's better.
I've just got a question about abuse reporting.
Yep.
Basically, we've got a situation up there where there's a boarding house that's had quite a few residents report several instances of abuse, neglect, exploitation, all of the stuff that we fight against.
Mm.
So what we've done is we've contacted the community visitor to go and have a look. The community visitor's come back and said that they couldn't identify any sort of a risk.
Yep. Let's try and focus on the question, Tanya.
So my question is, with the community visitor being the basically the people that oversee this and make sure that it runs properly, if they can't identify a risk, even though we know there is one, where do we go?
Colleen, probably. That's your question.
If I could just say that the community visitor program in Queensland is very different to the community visitor program here in Victoria, so I'm aware of that, that there are those differences. But, you know, I wasn't believed when I first started raising this issue, which is the experience that people with a disability have faced for a very long time. And when I was faced with that, when the minister told me it just simply couldn't be happening, not on her watch, what I had to do was collect the evidence, and I was so angry and I was so determined that what I did was I went out and I collected the evidence in whatever way that I could. So I think you have the individuals who are in the boarding house.
Yep.
Can they tell their story? Can you document their stories? Can you, where there's allegations of abuse, can you take it to the police? You just have to try and collect the evidence and keep raising it, keep trying to engage the community visitors. There is also a public advocate in Queensland. Now, again, the public advocate in Queensland is a very different office to my office, but I'd certainly be trying the public advocate as well. But really, the issue in addressing these issues is partnerships, coalitions, partnerships, and importantly, at the very front and centre has to be the people with a disability, because it's their stories that are the most powerful. So that's very difficult because of how difficult it is to tell stories that are painful and may end up re-victimising the individual, but you have to be able to tell the stories and collect the evidence and keep at it.
Tanya, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to stop it there because we are getting close to time, but we're very happy to talk to you after the after the break in the afternoon tea break.
No problem.
And thank you for your question.
Good on you, Tanya.
So I think that's really important advice, and I want to, just between now and the tea break, I want to get 10 seconds from each of the five of you, and I'm going to ask you one question, and that is, in the few minutes we have left, can we go along, what is the one piece of advice that you would give an advocate to get the best result from your office? You've got 10 seconds. Let's start this time with Grant.
Just keep at it. No, I'm with Bernie. Just keep on our hammer.
Kate.
There's lots of touch points with us, so come to us however, use our training, our phone line, our reference group, however. Just let it tell us the stories and see if we can help you.
Bernie.
Yeah, we have good days and bad days, so don't accept bad days. Don't accept us not listening. That's what I'm saying.
Colleen.
Same as everybody else, you have to be persistent and you have to make sure that your voice is loud enough that we hear.
Laurie. You've seen the cartoon, perhaps, of the drawing where the frog is halfway down the crane's throat or in its beak when the words underneath simply say, never give up. Never give up. The other thing, from my point of view, is I've been to every funded advocacy service in the state. I know most of the folks. The folks do the job on the smell of an oily rag.
Yep.
It's difficult. We understand that it's difficult, but never, ever give up.
Thank you. And, well, you've been given permission by five of your commissioners or commissioner-like people to keep coming back to them and keep being persistent. So that's a great thing for an advocacy conference to have. Please thank all of the captains that have been at the table today. Thanks very much. Now, remember, this session will be made available after the conference as a podcast, so look out for that. And as advocates, the one thing that you should always remember is, and this is a saying that keeps me going in many a tough situation, don't wait for the light at the end of the tunnel. Get down that tunnel and turn the bloody thing on yourself. thanks for putting up with me this afternoon. Robin, have we got any announcements before afternoon tea?
Yes, we do, Graham. Excellent. Thank you. And well done, Graham, on sharing what was a fabulous panel conversation.